rent growth, cap rate compression, that's going to make and break a lot of people. So those are obviously the easiest levers to make a deal. This is something that always needs to be taken into account. Is obviously you don't want to be too pessimistic, too conservative, but I'd rather be that than over optimistic.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everybody? You know the drill. Coming at you on Mondays with all things multifamily real estate investing. And today, another solo show. Going to be a little different than normal. And the reason for that is I wanted to remember legend in the real estate investing space, a man I'm sure most of you are familiar with, a man by the name of Sam Zell. Sam Zell passed away last week. He was the founder, chairman of Equity International, the kind of godfather of modern day private equity real estate investing, and also the godfather of the REIT industry. He was at the forefront of really turning REITs. And for those that aren't familiar with what a REIT is, it's a real estate investment trust. Essentially, it brought in a more liquid and accessible way to invest in real estate. It's traded on the stock market. We won't get into kind of the differences of what REIT investing versus non-REIT investing. By that, I mean to traditional real estate. We just won't get into that. But essentially, REIT is more of like a stock investment. You're investing in paper. You're not really investing in the asset that is real estate. Real estate just happens to be the underlying asset of the business you're investing in. But I digress on that. This episode is about Sam Zell. And he, like I said, shaped and changed the way the modern real estate investing world is today. He was known as the grave dancer. And I'll read a quote that kind of summarizes, a quote from himself that kind of summarizes that. And that's, in real estate, I'm known as the grave dancer. That was the title of an article I wrote back in 1976, and the nickname stuck. Some might see buying, creating value from others' mistakes as a form of exploitation, but I see it as giving neglected, devalued assets in any industry new life. That's who Sam Zell was. You know, he started off, he was in college, I believe he was going to get his JD, an attorney. He managed a 15-unit apartment building for an investor operator. He cold called the guy and asked him, he's like, hey, if I manage this building for you, can I get free room and board? And to his astonishment, the guy said yes. That was kind of the springboard into his real estate investing career. He started managing other properties for this owner. And by the time he graduated, they were managing, he was netting about $150,000 from this venture. And they were managing about over 4,000, him and his partner, Rob Lurie, which I got a lot of this information from his book, Am I Being Too Subtle? And if you're watching on YouTube, it's right here. Phenomenal book. I'll put it in the show notes, a link to get it. If you haven't read it, highly recommend it. It's one of my favorite books. Autobiography. It's just phenomenal read, great read, and a lot of nuggets. And that's what this episode's going to kind of be about. Just want to remember him through some of my favorite quotes, all of them taken from this book. So much to learn, both in real estate investing and life in general. But yeah, so graduated, he owned about 100 to 200 units outright himself with his partner and 4,000 apartment units. And he ended up selling his share of that management company to his partner and left to Chicago to practice law. And while he was there, he realized that the partners at his law firm and colleagues in general at his law firm, they more wanted to talk to him about his real estate ventures than his career as an attorney. And after a time, some even wanted to do deals with him. And he just realized that that's what he was good at. And that was his calling. So he ended up leaving being an attorney and went on to create what is now Equity International. He eventually brought on his former partner, Rob Lurie, to come work with him. And they grew it into what it is today. And Sam Zell had about a net worth of about $5.3 billion when he passed. That's what it was estimated. And he was part of the largest transaction at the time in 2006. Blackstone, which we're all familiar with, purchased Equity Office, which was its holding, right? Its REIT for office for $36 billion. So they purchased that from Sam Zell's company, which was at the time the largest leveraged buyout in history. And I'll get to a quote on this, but there's a quote he says on why he sold, because he was always known as just buy and hold, right? There's no need to sell. If you have a great cash flowing asset, a great location, great quality product, there's no need to sell. We'll get into that. But yeah, I kind of want to just remember him, just go read off of some quotes that always hit home with me and I think provide a lot of value and insight into the mind of a brilliant investor and brilliant person. So here we go. First one is, risk is the ultimate differentiator. I have always had a deep and complex relationship with it. I am not a reckless person, but taking risks is really the only way to consistently achieve above average returns in life as in investments. My father proved that when he left Poland. I am probably more comfortable with risk than most people. That's because I do as much as I can to understand it. To me, risk taking rests on the ability to see all the variables and then identify the ones that will make or break you. I think that's just a phenomenal quote. There's several parts there we can unpack. Obviously, the part about he's saying, you know, his father proved that by when he left Poland. For those that aren't familiar with this story, which does go into this book, is his family, his parents lived in Poland, soon to be at the time Nazi occupied Poland. And his father traveled for work and would hear what was happening around Europe, and he feared the worst. And so he did everything in his power to get his family out. He even tried to get friends and other family members to follow, but a lot just figured that's not going to happen to them. Nothing bad's going to happen. We know what ended up happening, but they ended up making it all the way to the United States through Europe, Asia, Japan to, I believe they landed in San Francisco and then finally made their way to Chicago. And so his point is just to get anything out of life that's worth having, there's going to be some level of risk you're going to have to take. And, you know, his father proved that. He was able to provide an amazing life for his kids in America, but that involved taking risk at the time. Now you look back and it's a no-brainer, right? But there was still risk. It wasn't just hopping on a train or a plane and coming over here. You know, they had to stay undercover. They sneak around, make sure they didn't get caught, go into unfriendly countries, pay people more than they probably should to get there. It was a lot of risk, right? They made it. And I think that's anything in life. You got to step outside of your comfort zone to grow, right? Growth comes out of you stepping out of that comfort zone, no matter what you want to do. So I think this is a phenomenal quote. And obviously, you also need to assess when you're taking risk, what can make or break you, like he says at the end here, because that's true. You don't just want to blindly take risks. This still wants to be an educated risk or educated guess, educated assumption. And you need to know, like, if I do this, what are the risks and which ones can actually completely break me? Stay away from those. All right, next quote. So 10 quotes. So that was the first one. Here's the second. I have always believed that every day you choose to hold an asset, you're also choosing to buy it. Would I buy our buildings at the price Blackstone was quoting? And this goes to what I was alluding to before. When I said traditionally buy and hold and never sold, but he sold Equity Office for $36 billion. And the reason he sold that is because every time anyone offered him a price, he would ask, would I buy it for that price? And if the answer was, no, I would not, that's way too much, right? Then he would consider selling because that was a great deal for him and his investors. If someone's going to buy a price so high that he would never even consider it, then sure. And so that's why he sold that. Quote three, while I was unaware of it at the time, my real compensation for that job wasn't monetary. It was learning about and getting comfortable with rejection. As I would later realize, indifference to rejection is a fundamental part of being an entrepreneur. And this kind of just hit home. I think this is so true. And not even just an entrepreneur, anything in life, there's going to be rejection, whatever you want to do, right? Obviously, as an entrepreneur, as a real estate investor, you're going to submit a lot of offers and there's going to be a lot of no's. Or if you're trying to raise money, there's going to be a lot of no's from people. Or if you're trying to date, there's going to be a lot of no's, right? Trying to get a new job, there's going to be some no's. If you're in sales, there's going to be a lot of no's. And you just have to get comfortable and be indifferent, not necessarily comfortable, but just indifferent to rejection. I think that is so important. And I think that is what's needed to be successful. That's one of the best qualities, because you can't be indifferent to rejection and you put a lot of energy and focus on that and it just consumes you. You're not going to step out the door and take the next step, the next action that's needed, because you're just going to be focusing on that negative energy, that feeling of rejection. So if this is you, I would focus on getting better at being indifferent. Don't take it personal, right? You know, you don't know what their no is. It's most likely not because of you. It's because of something in their life, right? Or they think they can do better. On to the next, right? All right. Four, redundancies are much more predictable and transparent than theoretical opportunities to add value. My focus is always on the downside. Overly optimistic assumptions lead to the graveyard of corporate acquisitions. And that's so true. And I think I've kind of been hitting on this over the last couple of years. I think we're going to see the graveyard coming soon in some instances. We've already seen a little bit with some portfolios, some properties, but I think we're going to see it more. And that's just overly optimistic. People saying that because of current supply and demand, that there's rents are still going to go up. Yeah, they still could, right? To a certain extent, but there's always going to be a point, no matter, even if you have really good supply and demand dynamics where there's so little supply to so much demand, there's only so much people can afford to pay. If wage growth is not going up at the same rate, it doesn't matter that doesn't matter the demand for the unit. They physically are only able to pay for so much. And I think that's something that people didn't realize. And also being over optimistic on the debt landscape, interest rates, buying so much over high leveraged floating rate debt that will break you. And just being too optimistic that cap rates will stay or if not continue to compress from where they are. I think those levers that people played, obviously rent growth, cap rate compression, that's going to make and break a lot of people. So those are obviously the easiest levers to make a deal look really good. And so I think this is something that always needs to be taken into account. It's obviously you don't want to be too pessimistic, too conservative, but I'd rather be that than over optimistic. But again, to his previous quote, there is some risk that needs to be taken in life. It just, you just need to know the ones that will make or break you. All right. Number five, where there is scarcity, price is no object. This basic tenet of supply and demand would later become a governing principle of my investment philosophy. That's kind of the whole, when there's blood in the streets, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others. When there's that scarcity mindset, price is no object, right? There's this that can't get over that scarcity mindset. And that allows you to kind of, I don't want to say get your way, but have more leverage, have more opportunity to buy at the price you want. Because essentially price is no object. All right. Number six, if you're not aware that you're not supposed to be able to do something, the barriers to doing it are dramatically lessened. I think this is a very, very powerful quote. And we've heard this from other entrepreneurs, successful businessmen, businesswomen that just been asked, are you able to do this? How'd you know you could do it? Time and time again, their answer is because I didn't know that's what I wasn't supposed to do. I've heard this story of this fix and flipper. He was doing, early in his career, he was doing 100 fix and flips a month, which if anyone's familiar with that business, that's an insane amount per month. There's only a few people that do that, a few businesses that do that, 100 a month. And the individuals he learned it from were just astonished. And they asked him, not like essentially, like, how do you have the audacity to know to do that 100? And how are you able to do that? And he's like, I thought that's what you were supposed to do. I see that you guys are doing that. I thought that's just how this business works. So it's just the power of not having those mental barriers. It just shows that the mental side of things is so powerful. 90-95% of everything is the mental side of it, right? The 10-5% is actually the ability and the action of doing it. Because we create these barriers in our heads and we create these false narratives that dictate our life. That's just not what it is, but our mind does that to us, right? Whereas if you create a narrative that is a positive, beneficial one, that is one of abundance, success, accomplishment, you're going to be able to achieve that. I thought that was just a great quote. All right. Next one. This has always been a fatal flaw in the U.S. real estate. The volume of development has been related to the availability of funds, not to demand. I think we're currently seeing this now. We're talking about some of the bigger, the darlings, right? The markets that have gotten the most press, right? You got the Austins, got the Phoenixes that have just had insane rent growth, insane appreciation price, which has, and at the time, late 2020 through early 2022, we have rates of sub 4, sub 3%. People could get money really cheap, almost free money. And developers could do the same thing. So why wouldn't they? You're telling me I can get 20% rent bump in this market and I can borrow money at 3%, let's do it. And I feel like that's going to hurt those markets in the long run because the pipeline is so big in those markets that once all those come online, the supply is going to outweigh the demand and it's going to either keep rents flat or even drop them a little bit because there's going to be so much supply and so much supply of newer product. When there's so much supply of newer product, is that these developers have to fill their buildings before they sell them. Or even if they're going to keep them, they just got to fill them, right? To bring in revenue. And what do? They do concessions, right? You get 1 month free, 2 month free. You get an introductory rate of this for the first 6 months, 12 months, whatever it happens to be. And they just fill these properties up that in the moment dilutes and artificially brings down market rent because they're doing it to fill their product, to fill their building. But then the surrounding buildings have to do the same because they're losing tenants to this newer building that's cheaper. And that in the moment hurts the rental market. And I feel that's what we're going to see in some of these major markets that have just been building and building because they were the darlings of the real estate world, real estate market, and rates were so cheap to lend, to borrow at that time. And I feel that's what we're going to see. All right, next quote. Some emerging markets will check all the boxes. Strong population growth, growing middle class, verge of investment grade, great leadership, and hunger for capital. And then be missing the one ingredient that enables you to monetize your investment, scale. Without scale, you don't have liquidity. You have no optionality. In essence, you're stuck. I like this quote because scale to me is important in any business. Yes, you can have all those other factors that make your current business run very well. But when it comes to liquidity and an exit, scale is what gets you there. I've seen it time and time again in many different industries. You have a solid business that makes a lot of money, but there's no scale there. So anyone that would want to buy that is not because there's no scale. And you've been able to run that business because you've lived and breathed that for years and you are living in that business, running that business. And that's not what this next person wants or can do. There's no scale for them. Essentially, it runs because you're there, right? And I don't think that's the main angle he was taking with this quote, but that's just what I've seen. And in terms of real estate, obviously the scale part, right? It's owning 100 single family homes or owning one complex. There's scale in the one complex all located there, less roofs, less mechanicals. You have site on staff that can manage the entire property versus having to jump around to all different locations for those 100 single family homes. It's also that the units are essentially all the same. They all have the same parts. So you don't need to inventory all different types of replacement parts. They're all the same, right? So it makes it more cost effective and easier to scale. And that's what growing in a business, especially in real estate, is about, being able to effectively scale and operate your business in all market cycles. And to be able to do that, in my opinion, you need efficiencies. And creating scale where you can have those efficiencies makes your life so much easier. All right, number nine. So quote number nine, I believe the fundamentals of business, supply and demand, liquidity equals value, good corporate governance, and reliable partners, to name a few, apply across the board. Yes, I just like this quote because I think it's true in whatever you want to do, right? There needs to be that supply and demand. You don't want to go into a diluted market where it's oversupplied, then you just become a commodity. Obviously, liquidity equals value. That's true. That's why he was big into REITs, because it provided more liquidity. However, you lost some of the other upsides of real estate, having control of the asset itself, power of depreciation, and other tax advantages. But I believe that multifamily is generally more liquid than most other asset classes. And the reason I believe that, well, one, it's a fundamental need in the world. You need a place to live, but also the fact that there's agency lending, right, that are backed by the federal government and they're mandated by the government to loan out a certain amount of money, billions and billions of dollars every year to pretty much so they do their best to try to keep housing as affordable as possible. Now, that's a different conversation. Is it actually working? But that's the point, right? So they lend at more favorable terms. Thereby, the thinking is then landlords, operators can then rent out at a more affordable rate because they have more favorable debt terms. They don't have to jack the rate up to be able to afford this property and this debt payment, right? So to me, having that as a backstop makes it more liquid than other asset classes because you have that optionality that creates really strong debt, right? Then thereby very strong cash flowing properties if bought correctly, right? And obviously the good corporate governance, you need good people running businesses, right? It comes down to people and culture. And I think good corporate governance is about that. And obviously reliable partners, that's important too. I think you want to date before you get married to anyone and make sure that that person's filling in your holes and you're filling in theirs, right? That can create a great relationship and business relationship, right? And you can make a lot of money and have great success. All right, last quote. And this one is probably one that really hit me when I was reading this book, because I was reading this book, I don't know, 2 years ago, a year ago. Yeah, probably a year ago when inflation was crazy, right? talking 9% year over year CPI, which what they're telling us was probably more like 15 to 18%. And this quote just hit me. I knew these fundamentals, but the way he said it, and it was just, yeah, that's what one of the reasons this is such a powerful investment vehicle. And so the quote goes, "We believed the real money in real estate came from borrowing long-term fixed rate debt in an inflationary scenario and ultimately depreciated the value of the loan and increased the position of the borrower." And you've heard me talk about this before, debt debasement, essentially, yeah, you're deflating or depreciating the value of the loan because you're getting a fixed rate that's in today's dollars. So today's nominal dollars, not in future inflationary dollars. So 10 years from now, when inflation has, when things cost way more than they did when you started the loan, you're still paying that same amount, that same fixed amount. At that point, probably have increased your rents as well. So your top line has been going up, but your biggest expense has remained the same. And that's very powerful. All right, guys, I just want to get on here and share some quotes from the book, I Am Being Too Subtle by Sam Zell. He was a legend in our space. A lot can be learned from him. I think I'm going to read the book again because there's some great stories and always nuggets you can pick up. If you haven't read it, you should. I'll put it in the show notes. But as always, easy doesn't pay well. Instant gratification is self-destructive. So not only get out there and work hard for your money, but have your money work hard for you. Then we can all create the lives of our dreams and we can make this world a better place. All right, everybody. Catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.